Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Will Trump pick as his Veep and farewell to Joe Lieberman? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook Medal and Maddie Kearns and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsor this episode is Made in Cookware. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So MBD, Trump Veep stakes beginning to start in earnest. A lot of speculation among the chattering class. We are, unfortunately, part of the chattering class, a fact, if not in spirit. So who do you like?
Who do I like, or who do I think will be the choice? Those are two very different questions.
You can address both in your own inimitable way.
Well, I think that there are. I actually think he has several options. It depends on what kind of VP he wants. Does he want a kind of co-president VP that could handle a serious policy portfolio for him, and would be a good potential successor? Then I think he should look to senators, like capable senators like Tom Cotton or, J.D. Vance has been mentioned. I know that he's a favorite among some of the family, like Don Jr., because he's seen as aligned with the Trump idea in the party. But I've heard and I'm not entirely convinced he wouldn't go with a kind of insurance policy choice, a choice where it would be insurance against impeachment and removal, because the political class wouldn't want to see Dr. Ben Carson suddenly become president, or Tulsi Gabbard.
There's no way they're impeaching and removing him, right? If Tulsi is going to be the successor.
Is that right? if that's going to be, and because she's neither welcomed by elected Republicans nor admired by any elected Democrats.
Allow Trump to start the push to repeal the amendment and let him run a third term if Tulsi is the successor.
So I don't know. I mean, I think the wisest choice is always try to find someone who helps you win a state you need. Although I don't think there's an obvious choice for shoring up Pennsylvania or Michigan in this case. I'm
intrigued by the Tom Cotton idea because I've
seen Tom Cotton even kind of move in Trump's direction on Ukraine, at least somewhat in that last vote, which surprised me. And I think Tom Cotton is a serious guy. I don't agree with him on foreign policy all the time, but I take him very seriously as a figure in the Senate. And I think he would do credit to the Republican ticket.
Yeah, I'm a huge admirer of Tom Cotton. I think kind of the safest sort of governing choice, if you're going to go that way, kind of a Cheney-like pick would be Mike Pompeo. did a very good job at CIA and state, survived all 4 years afterwards. There was some tensions with Trump. He was critical in a couple respects, but he hasn't been since. And the word is Trump's forgiven him. But Pompeo's not going to light up the campaign trail, is not going to help in any specific state. And my guess, Maddie, is that Trump will be motivated, given the stakes here. You know, every presidential election is big, but when you potentially could be looking at jail time, if you lose, it's even bigger personally. So I think he's going to take this seriously and try to find someone who would help him electorally. Veep choices don't make big differences, but they can make a difference at the margins.
Yeah, so if you look at his logic in 2016, you know, I think Trump obviously was trying to do the typical thing that you do, which is you find a candidate who can balance you in some way. So Mike Pence is steady, he's religious, he's Midwestern, and that was very appealing for pro-lifers for whom Trump was an unknown quantity. I don't think that's where he's thinking, though. I think now the real thing that matters to him most is loyalty. And you know, I'm thinking of people like Tim Scott, who would obviously be helpful because he's the only Black Republican in the Senate. He has political experience. Obviously, South Carolina isn't that critical, and it's kind of an easy win for Trump. But Tim Scott is shown now that he's loyal to Trump. But unfortunately, a lot of people who are loyal to Trump have their own problems. So whereas like Pence was to the right of Trump on abortion, and that was useful, now he doesn't really want somebody to the right of him on abortion. And in fact, all the conversation about how good it would be to have a female VP, be it Kristi Noem or, you know, someone like Elise Stefanik, these women are also to the right of Trump on abortion. I think that's going to be a deterrent for him, because I think he sees that, and it is a significant political threat, as a political liability. And so he's just going to want someone who's totally loyal. You know, I don't think that Vivek Ramaswamy has much of a chance, given that he's proven how unpopular he can be the more that the public get to know him. But somebody who will just basically do Trump's bidding, no matter what, is probably his biggest priority at this point.
Yeah, loyalty is obviously a huge thing. And Charlie, the Pence model is, unfortunately, from where I sit and a lot of us sit, is just really no longer operative. So in 16, Trump was this strange interloper in the Republican Party, and he needed to reassure big elements of the Republican Party as it then existed. That's no longer the case, and that's why I do not discount at all the possibility of a J.D. Vance pick, which is the opposite of a Mike Pence pick. It's like, no, we don't need to placate the rest of the party. We are the party, and we're the future, and this is the ideology that's now dominant, and we need to assure it'll continue to be dominant, and trying to find a successor and sort of have that long view rather than a view just to November and go with this guy who's taken up this ideological baton.
I think it's entirely possible that Donald Trump thinks in the way that you have just described, but I don't think if he does that it will help him. Because the operative question remains the same as it was in 2016. It's just that the answer is different. The operative question is, who do I need to shore up? Who do I need to convince? Back in 2016, the answer was people who are accustomed to voting Republican and believe in traditional Republican things. You're absolutely right, Rich, to say that that's not the question so much now. But that doesn't mean there isn't a question. The question now is what Donald Trump is going to do to shore up the suburbs, the people who historically voted Republican but may not have been entirely ideologically committed to the movement in the way that Mike Pence is, people who just weren't Democrats or liked lower taxes or opposed soft on crime policies, who have drifted away. People who, it is fair to say, were less conservative and less Republican than many people thought, but who nevertheless show up to the polls every time. That's Trump's problem. If he loses, it is going to be because the calculation that Chuck Schumer was so thrilled about in 2016, that for every new Trump voter, two suburban voters go away, actually came to fruition. It didn't happen in 2016, but it started to by 18, and it did in 20, and it did in 22 in some states as well. I think Trump has to think very carefully about what he's going to do to win enough of those people to make his candidacy viable. J.D. Vance won't cut it. If the polling was 60-40, sure, you can pick whoever you want. I don't like J.D. Vance at all, but that wouldn't be the question. But it's not. Trump's doing okay. I think Biden is rising a little bit in the fortunes. But he's going to have to either convince those people to sit at home and not go and vote for Joe Biden, or to go out and vote for him despite themselves. And the way you do that is you diversify the ticket. You don't double down.
All right. So let me do a multi-barreled exit question and get a one sentence reaction to these Veep possibilities. I'll start with you first, MBD, a real quick take. Tim Scott.
Doesn't move the needle.
Charlie.
Oddly enough, I think Michael's right now that I'm being asked this question. I think perhaps had I considered it without thinking it through, I would have thought Tim Scott would help, but maybe he doesn't actually.
Maddie.
I think he ticks the right boxes, but he did perform terribly in the GOP primary. Obviously, that didn't stop Biden picking Kamala, but he's a liability.
I would have been much more favorable to this idea 6 months ago or so. There's just Scott, he's likable and enthusiastic, and bizarrely, as Trump has pointed out, in a way, you know, geared to kind of put Scott down as well as praising him the way Trump often does. He has seemed more enthusiastic about Trump than he was about himself, but it's been painful to watch and kind of cringeworthy. So I'm just not sure he's up for this. And I think even if he got it and Trump wins, he'd end up, I think, negotiating the relationship with Trump behind the scenes is a huge element of this job. It always is, but it's much more when dealing with Trump. And I just don't have faith that Scott would be deft enough to pull that off. So I also have a negative reaction. Go around the horn again. MBD, Kristi Noem.
Potential scandal.
Charlie.
I think Kristi Noem's a liability. The allegations against her that I assume Michael is referring to there seem pretty credible. She has taken of late to using Twitter to hawk products in South Dakota. It's almost idiocracy. Mm-hmm. Where
is there some drill, some tooth thing, something was mentioning to me, some dental?
Yeah, where she says, hi, it's Kristi Noem, governor from South Dakota. I do love my secure shoes that I bought for, you know, it's odd. Also, she has been widely criticized by many within the conservative movement, both for her response to COVID, as distinct from the South Dakota legislature's response, and her softness on the trans question. So I think there's too much there to take the risk.
Manny.
Yeah, I don't think that it's going to be her alleged sexual impropriety that sinks her in Trump's eyes. I mean, this is the presidential candidate who is, you know, the porn stars, rape allegations, locker room talk. I mean, I really don't think this is going to concern him very much. But I do think that she's got great political experience. She has a good record on COVID. She has, you're right that she's made some key mistakes on culture war issues, but she has sort of tried to compensate for that recently. However, she, I think, is too restrictionist on abortion for Trump's tastes.
So I'm also down on her. I think she's an embarrassment waiting to happen, even if you put aside the rumored affair. MBD, Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Ticks the boxes, but isn't except the aspirational one.
Meaning to be president, or
I think there's something like she's, you know, got the brand right as far as like I'm a conservative, I'm a mom, I care about, you know, the issues that a lot of women in the suburbs care about, education, etc. But there's something she lacks, like some sort of like pizzazz thing that you would want on the Trump ticket, or that I think Trump would want. Mm-hmm. You know, that maybe other candidates have. You know, it'd be there's like a political odd couple effect there.
Mm-hmm.
Where you know, he's like such a brassy star, and she's so much more earthy.
Yeah, really.
I think it would be a stronger choice than it might look. She's got good communication skills. She's non-threatening. She's a mother. She's a governor. She's solid on policy. She's a steady hand on the tiller. I don't think it would be a home run, but I think he could do a lot worse.
Maddie?
Yeah, I agree with Charlie. I think that she could potentially help with suburban women, but she's, you know, she's lacking a kind of wow factor, which doesn't really matter, honestly, because that Trump feels that he does that enough.
There's a lot of wow on the ticket regardless.
Exactly.
I like her. I think she'd be a good pick. She's governor, hasn't been governor for long. So there is a question of whether she'd be ready on day one to be president, but she's kind of been under the national spotlight and pressure, not as a principal herself, but it was not easy being press secretary for Donald Trump. She's winsome. She's a good communicator. She has great mom stories. She has a cancer survival story. She's non-threatening, could help a little bit in the suburbs. At the same time, you know, she's on board with Trumpism and MAGA. So I like her. JD, MBD. Don't go too crazy here. Don't go too over the top.
I mean, listen, I no secret about it. I admire JD. He blurred my book. We're, you know, I would consider him a friend. I want to see him in the Senate for a long time, and, you know, worry about the risks of being on a losing ticket would do to him politically. I think he's a very effective senator and already has a very effective office running, and that he belongs there in a way for the long term. But, you know, it'd be really hard. I think it'd be really hard to pass up because, of course, you end up having only one term sitting between you and being the leader of the party if you're elected.
Yeah, I think he said publicly, or is telling people, you know, I'd think about it if Trump asked me. Oh, he would take it in a heartbeat. Charlie.
Well, there's two questions here. What do I think of J.D. Vance? Not a fan, not my sort of conservatism. Then there is the question of whether it would be a good idea. I think I've already outlined the case against it. Now, there are some times at which the ticket is not diversified and it works. For example, Bill Clinton and Al Gore were both Southern Baptist boys.
Yeah, that was a brilliant pick in that moment in time.
Yeah. So if the country is deemed to be in that sort of mood, sure. I just don't think that's where Trump's weakness is. I think he's maxed out on in that sort of mood, and he needs to appeal to people who think things are broadly okay, but just don't like Biden's policies.
By the way, if it were Vance, I do think Vance would help him on governing. Like, I do think Vance's office brings with it, you know, a sense of like what legislating is and what it requires already. So I do think that would be a tick in the box for him.
Maddie?
Yeah, I mean, Ohio's obviously very important, although Trump did win Ohio the last two times without help. And I think Michael makes a good point that from the MAGA perspective, JD may do more good in the Senate. But yeah, I mean, certainly he's got the loyalty factor, which matters a lot to Trump.
Yeah, I don't think he brings anything electorally because Ohio's no longer a swing state. I don't think there's anything to indicate, you know, he's a great campaigner. This, as we were talking about with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, is going to be an issue with a lot of people. But he was at that Ohio bloodbath rally and Trump had him come up and JD just looked like a child, like a child compared to Trump. But it's hard for anyone to be as big a persona as Trump, especially on a rally stage. But I don't discount the possibility. I think he would have a lot of appeal to MAGA, a lot of appeal to people close to Trump. And I don't think he would hurt in the fall and would have some benefits after that. MBD, Katie Britt.
You know, actually don't think it's... she's gotten so dumped on for that performance in the SOTY response. I actually think she's underrated as a political figure now officially, and to the point where I would say, like, I don't think she's actually a bad fit. I think if she just got a little bit more coaching on modulating her delivery and, you know, didn't do the theater
exactly
thing.
She needs more coaching.
Well, you know what I mean.
Less naturally, like, Senator Britt.
No more coaching.
No, you know, the coaching is in, like, ease up. Like,
yeah, the coaching is, yeah, forget we're coaching you. Try to forget we're coaching.
So, no, but I think she fits, actually. You know, I don't know if she'd have the sort of like heartbeat away day one quality that a lot of people seek, but for balancing the ticket a little bit, for, you know, for being a little bit of a performer, I think it works.
Charlie?
I don't know. I like her and I hope she stays in the Senate for a long time, but that performance was not good. It was odd. And, you know, I have just been through an election attempt in which people told me, look, fine, DeSantis has all of these problems in the way he performs, not as a governor, he's a wonderful governor, but as a politician, but he's going to nail it once the bright lights are on. And it just didn't happen. And I wouldn't take the risk. I don't think you would look at that and say, perfect audition tape, let's put her on the national stage. At least wait a while.
Maddie?
Yeah, no, I agree with Charlie 100%. I think that State of the Union response was really dreadful. And he might say, oh, well, that's not everything. But, like, that raised her profile for the worse. And, you know, a lot of people watch Saturday Night Live. A lot of people saw the clips. And certainly, like, she presents certain advantages, her age, being female, but these are all advantages that are applicable to somebody like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who I think would just be a safer bet.
Yeah, I agree with Charlie and Maddie. The thing, it wasn't just a bad performance. We've seen many of those, and those responses, not easy duty, but it was weird and funny, you know, which is really makes it much worse. And that's just the way she talks in public. She was on Fox News Sunday, I think it was, the weekend after, and that's the way she speaks. You know, it's not the way she naturally speaks, because there was a little preview video she did prior to the response where she was fine and kind of winsome in the way she was talking, but that's not the way she talks. I don't totally discount her as a possibility, though, because, you know, with Trump, the superficial stuff matters, and she's attractive, and that's why I don't think you can totally scratch her off the list. MBD, Marco.
I mean, the state problem is an issue. Someone has to move, Trump or Marco Rubio, but Marco's a very effective communicator. There is supposedly a shift underway of Hispanic voters into the GOP, or people who identify as Hispanic into the GOP. And, you know, I think he is totally credible as a credible advocate for that section of the party that comes out of the working and lower middle class. You know, going all the way back to his announcement speech in 2015, which I thought was a phenomenal speech. And if he sounds those themes, I think he could really help the ticket.
Charlie?
I think it's the best choice of those you have mentioned. He is a good politician. He, put it nicely, is willing to shift with the ideological winds to stay on the right side of the party. He speaks fluent Spanish. And as Michael says, if this is an election in which we do see a shift toward the Republican Party among Hispanics and African Americans, then he could be helpful. I just think the state question is intractable, because Donald Trump is not going to move state. His ego will not allow him to be the guy who re-registers. If I am wrong about that, I will say so on a future episode. And Marco Rubio is a senator in Florida. He would have to resign from the Senate to move. He's also a Florida man. This isn't, you know, Mitt Romney, who happily runs in all manner of different places. That's not a criticism, but Romney is peripatetic.
Right.
Marco Rubio is not. He's Cuban. He knows only Florida. When you think of Marco Rubio, you think Miami, Florida. Yeah. And for him to say, oh, now I live in Nashville or something, would just be really weird.
Yeah. Maddie?
Yeah. I mean, that's the obvious weakness. He does have Latino appeal. I think he appeals to, obviously, working class voters, but also he does talk in a way that I think is attractive to the middle class. Trump has said some very memorably insulting things about him. I mean, I know that's true of like almost everyone, but you know, the size of his hands and him being sweaty. So it's kind of, as you were referencing the sort of charisma gap between Trump and JD, I sort of feel like there's a big charisma gap with Rubio as well, mm-hmm. but not that's the most important thing.
Does Rubio help Trump with some white voters who think Trump is racist? Like,
see, I think Marco, I think he'd be a pretty good choice if you abstract from the Florida issue, the being from the same state issue. And I see him having appeal to Latinos and being able to go around campaigning, speaking fluent Spanish. But I don't see Marco having working class appeal. It reminds me a little bit, you know, the old saw about he's an old person's idea of a young person. I think he's a little bit like non-working class person's idea of a working class politician. But you know, he brings a youthfulness. He's MAGA-ish now without being threatening. So I think he'd be pretty good.
I don't think he needs to appeal to working class people, though. I think he needs to be an effective surrogate in two languages for Donald Trump's appeal to working class people. And that's where I think that he would add value. And if it is true that he's not appealing to working class people, and that in fact he is the preference of middle class and upper middle class people, as was certainly the case in 2016, then that helps too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, no, I think that's well stated. All right, so final, there are names I'm leaving off, but we could go on and on about this and already have. Mike Pompeo, MBD.
I guess Dick Cheney 2.0, I mean, it's a case for gravitas and foreign policy interest. I don't think he adds anything like electorally. I don't particularly love the foreign policy on offer there either. I don't think he would hurt or drag the ticket down or be liable to say anything, you know, silly, in a debate. I mean, I think he would tower over Kamala Harris and over RFK's pick. What's her face? I've already forgotten.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't think I ever knew.
Shanahan.
Charlie.
I think it would be too much of an adjustment. I have been the guy here who has said he really needs to win the suburbs, but I'm not sure he's effective enough at that. But he will be roundly criticized by the Trump faithful. So many people who Trump hired seem to have turned out to be terrible in the eyes of the MAGA movement. No one ever asks whether or not Trump is good at hiring people, of course. But I just see endless vitriol aimed at Mike Pompeo and almost anyone who ever worked in Trump's cabinet. And I just can't see how he would thread that needle in the optimum way.
Maddie?
I think that he's going to fail Trump's loyalty test. Did sort of say quite critical things of him towards the end of the administration, and he is an establishment type. But he's a serious guy, a very smart guy, and as much as, you know, his foreign policy might be controversial, this is a time in which people want strong, decisive people handling foreign policy.
Yeah.
He wants the job too.
Well, that's what I was going to say is I'm not sure. No one turns down Veep. So if it's offered, you take it. But he may really want defense more than Veep. But as we go through these, I think my choice to categorize them crudely, the choice among the women alternatives is Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Choice among senators would be Marco. And safe governing choice would be Pompeo, but maybe, you know, that may be because I'm non-MAGA, and it may be that if you're MAGA, your governing choice, as we discussed, is JD. With that, let's hear from our sponsor this episode, Made In Cookware. If you're considering the pros and cons of different cookware brands, you should know that Made In has more of the pros like Tom Colicchio, Nancy Silverton, Brooke Williamson, and many other professional chefs who all trust their cooking to Made In Cookware. Fact is, Made In has a long-standing relationship with professional chefs. The company evolved from a 100-year-old kitchen supply business and works with multi-generational makers to craft each piece. They make exactly what demanding chefs are looking for, including a wide selection of curated products from carbon steel to stainless clad, plus plateware, glassware, and more. But perhaps the biggest pro is that Made In is sold online and delivered to your door, all for a fraction of the price of other top brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, invest in Made In Cookware. Once you try it, you'll be pro Made In too. And I am pro Made In because we have a number of Made In pans here. And every time I pick one up, it's a wonderful experience. It just feels great in your hand. It cooks evenly. It is easy to clean, which is very important for everyone. So they're truly wonderful products, and you can just feel the difference from other cookware you might have, other inferior cookware you might have in your kitchen. And right now, editors, listeners get 10% off full priced items from Made In. For full details, visit madeincookware.com/editors. That's MADEIN cookware.com/editors. Please check it out. I guarantee you won't regret it. So, Maddie, we had oral arguments before the Supreme Court in this abortion pill case. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so I think it's been, I mean, it's, there's a few things to kind of separate. The actual legal question is quite narrow. So chemical abortions make up like 60% of abortions in the US now. And this was a case challenging the FDA rules relaxing prescription of these abortion pills. So this actually began under the Clinton administration. They sort of suggested that an unwanted pregnancy is a serious or life-threatening illness, which is obviously ridiculous. But when that was brought in initially, women had to get several in-person visits and at least be given the pill in person. And there was also a gestational limit. So it was for a pregnancy of 7 weeks or less. And really since then, we've seen a continuing liberalization of even those restrictions. So in 2016, the gestational limit was extended to 10 weeks. And then in 2021, during COVID, the FDA exercised enforcement discretion and basically allowed women to get this through telemedicine. And that they decided to basically keep as the new rule. And the Attorney General Merrick Garland claimed that the authority to allow this pill to be sent through the mail into states where even abortion is illegal, he claimed they had that authority, and there's a good case that's a violation of state law and Comstock. So the pro-life doctors in this case were suing the Fifth Circuit appeal. The federal judge blocked this, and so the Biden administration, the FDA, DOJ, and actually the manufacturer of this pill were challenging this and asking the Supreme Court to overrule the Fifth Circuit. The initial thing here where I think there's a kind of, which makes it narrow, is this question of legal standing. So the plaintiffs in the case are medical doctors are saying that this is basically interfered with their conscience rights and made it difficult for them to do their jobs because people are presenting at higher rates to emergency rooms with complications from these drugs. That's a whole legal argument, and it's not actually clear, I think, from the oral arguments where the justices are going to come down with that. If they do, like, they seem skeptical of the plaintiff's standings, and you know, all of that is kind of an unknown quantity. But I think that the bigger issue here is sort of on the merits. So if you just think of like sending abortion drugs into states where abortion is illegal, I mean, what is to stop a woman attempting to use it later than 10 weeks? And this is obviously using these drugs at any point in pregnancy is unsafe for the baby, but there's also a serious question about safety to the mother as well. There's a horrible case in the UK where they had similar relaxation of these laws during COVID, where a woman used it well into her third trimester and her baby died a horribly painful death. And she also required emergency medical attention. The other element to this, of course, is what's to stop a woman who is being abused or even a minor female from requesting pills under duress? You know, one woman, I think, who was outside the Supreme Court was this woman in Texas whose husband, who'd been having an affair, had been getting abortion pills through the mail and poisoning her when she was in her pregnancy. The baby survived miraculously, and he's now in jail. But you know, there's all sorts of ways in which this can be abused, in which this wouldn't be safe, in which you'd want, at the very least, just from the argument of safety for the women, you'd want medical supervision of these drugs.
But MBD, this is unfortunately a real lesson in incrementalism and working the system, because you know, three Democratic administrations now, you know, at least the first two, Clinton and Obama, right at the end, you know, they do something to advance the ball on this, and they do it in a way that can't be challenged, and lo and behold, they just want to make it a norm and have made significant progress.
Right, and then the norm gets reinforced by, you know, a kind of establishmentarian bias in, you know, medical studies, et cetera. You know, like I was looking ahead of this segment, and, you know, of course, just before this issue goes to the Supreme Court, you know, there's like three or four new studies showing it, you know, published in the last couple months, saying that telemedicine prescription of emergency contraceptions or RU486 and abortion drugs is just as safe as, going in to be seen by a doctor when in fact, like, we know intuitively that Maddie is, of course, bringing up a very real issue, which is that face-to-face appointments allow doctors to evaluate whether someone is under duress, under other, potentially under compulsion, under, have other medical issues that are unresolved or incompatible with taking these drugs.
Or even maybe just how far along a woman is. I mean, that also cannot be ascertained reliably from telemedicine.
Right. And it's much easier for a person to to not know, just judging by their own sexual history. So it's certainly an issue where they've advanced the ball. And I've actually been surprised that there haven't been more technical advances in these drugs since the Clinton years. The cases Maddie's talking about of people presenting at emergency rooms are still frequent enough, I think, to give not just pro-lifers pause. So, this has been a known difficulty for the pro-life movement that, chemical abortions would take up, in a sense, the slack in surgical abortions as that practice continues to kind of go down or take on an odor of being the irresponsible, choice, or the thing that happens to people who aren't responsible and don't take care of things early in a pregnancy. This is just part of it.
Yeah, Charlie, another thing that's going on, this is happening in pretty frank defiance of federal law, the Comstock Act, passed in 1873, which I guess can be ignored because this involves availability of abortion, which trumps everything, and the federal statute being ignored is called the Comstock Act.
Well, it doesn't trump everything anymore, but the way in which this issue has been discussed demonstrates to me that we have not yet adapted as a country to Roe's demise. The questions here are quite complicated. There's a standing issue, whether or not there is anyone who has the power to sue. This is a favorite trick at the moment of the Biden administration. There's a statutory question. There's an unusual claim being made that the FDA doesn't need to consider the Comstock Act that I don't quite understand, but that I've seen dismissed by people I respect. And then there's a long history of on the merits debates about FDA authority and decision making and the way we promulgate rules. But that's not how we're talking about this in our politics, is it? In court, those questions are being disputed, but in our politics, we're still talking about whether or not the pill is good, whether or not the pill should be, in some cosmic sense, on the market. That's what's interested me. I don't think we've quite got past the old legal questions yet. I am, although not an expert on this or this area, I am persuaded that the Democrats are playing games here. I also think that they're playing games that are probably politically useful to them. That doesn't justify it, but they want to be able to say that having promised to return the question of abortion to the states, Republicans are doing whatever they can to limit it nationally. That is in part what this is about, much as the over-the-counter birth control pill in Colorado was about telling women that Republicans wanted to take away their birth control under Obamacare. This is a political question, and I don't know how it's going to be resolved, but I do think it's indicative of a country that is not at all yet at ease with its new legal regimen.
So, Maddie, next question to you. We are losing and will continue to lose the fight against chemical abortion. Yes or no?
Yes, unfortunately.
MBD.
Yeah, I agree with Maddie.
Charlie?
Yeah, I think so in the short term, but I don't think so in the long term. I think it will balance out, and I think that the Democrats will push too far because they also have some pretty unpopular views on abortion. And there's an irony there, isn't there, in that the more we lose, the closer we get toward the equilibrium. Not an equilibrium I want, but the more states we lose in, the more scope there is for the next step, which is one that will be unpopular in the country at large, and then, if not redound to Republicans' benefit, perhaps neutralize the issue in most places.
I also think the answer is yes. With that, let me just say thank you to all our readers out there who contributed to our recently concluded webathon. It was a dual giving webathon, which meant we're telling people they could give to NR Inc. or give to National Review Institute, a nonprofit, and we had a goal of $100,000 for NR Inc. and $50,000 for NRI, and reached and exceeded both goals. So I know reading webathon pitches is not the greatest reading experience for our readers, but so many of you, basically 1,000 every time we have one of these webathons, it was split a little bit, as you'd expect, between NR and NRI, but still added up to about 1,000 this time. It's really amazing and heartening to us, and makes a big difference. With that, Charlie, unexpectedly, we have lost Joe Lieberman, a four-term senator from Connecticut, a vice presidential candidate with Al Gore in 2000, almost a vice presidential candidate again in 2008 for the other party. So to be a losing vice presidential candidate twice, which would have been a real possibility on different party tickets, that's never been done before, right? And a real statesman. He was very involved in the No Labels Project, which doesn't seem to be getting off the ground. They're having trouble, just a little detail, finding a candidate who's willing to run on that topic. On that ticket, but a very public-spirited man, and obviously marched to his own drummer, which is what left him basically without a party at the end.
It did. I like people who believe in things. Yes, even when they aren't the same things that I believe in. Now, there was some crossover with Joe Lieberman, which is why I believe National Review preferred him over the Democratic alternative in Connecticut when he ran for Senate as an independent. What year was that? 2012? But Joe Lieberman was somebody who actually thought about politics. Again, conclusions not mine much of the time. But goodness me, doesn't that seem appealing at the moment? Tribalism is a word that is overused. We have two tendencies in this country, and they are expressed through the two major parties. That's not a bad thing. It's not a false thing either. That happens naturally. It's happened right from the beginning of the Republic. I know that the plan was that everyone would be independent-minded and there'd be no parties or factions, but that just didn't last too long.
Yeah, it ended up being, ironically, because they didn't want it to happen, one of the most important inventions of the founders.
That's right. And by 1800, the acrimony between the two was extraordinary. We should remember that because we always think we live in unusual times. We don't. My point, though, is that there is the normal division of visions, and then there is what we have at the moment, which in many cases is blind loyalty, and even worse, is cult-like behavior in which people who are prominent in either party make up on the spot what it is that they believe or that their party is supposed to be believed, and then try to enforce it as dogma. And when I think about Joe Lieberman, I think about somebody who didn't really go for that. And you can tell he didn't go for it because he was, much to the chagrin of his own team, skeptical toward the one policy that his party had hoped to put into place for decades, universal health care, or at least alleged universal health care. Lieberman pushed back and pushed back. He provoked an enormous amount of hatred by doing so. Ezra Klein, I won't repeat what he said about him, but it was grotesque, was perhaps most famously critical, and Lieberman didn't care. And then when he paid the price for it, he ran as an independent and he won, and he kept saying what he thought. He was friends, I believe, with William F. Buckley Jr., which means he was clearly open-minded, because the two were not on the same page on key matters. So much as with Senator Sinema, although I am not going to be lining up in the Lieberman faction anytime soon, I do think it's a shame when these people are kicked out of our politics. And I think it says something bad about our politics when, especially in places that are more moderate than they perhaps look, they are made unviable by dint of their individuality.
Yeah, Maddie, so he was a conviction politician, which is a plus on the ledger, and also just a profoundly decent man who was capable of having friendships that were across party lines and with people who disagreed with them, and just treated his opponents with respect, which is something that's an increasingly rare quality in American public life.
Yeah, definitely. And he, you know, he was an Orthodox Jew and wouldn't use transport on the Sabbath, and displayed sort of concern for his moral principles when Clinton had his affair with Lewinsky, and he sort of slammed this as immoral and disgraceful, losing a lot of popularity from fellow Democrats at the time. So yeah, he was definitely a decent man who lived by his lights. Obviously, it was his orthodoxy wasn't enough to make him pro-life, which is a shame. But I'm sure he was just wrong on that in a good faith way. Of course, nobody wants to be remembered for the way in which they died. They want to be remembered for the kind of person they were. But I have to say, Rich, when I read the news that he died at 82 from complications from a fall,
mm-hmm.
It's one of those sobering moments when you think, gosh, he was what, 1 year older than the president, and just complications from a fall. That's all it can take when you live to a long age. I mean, he wrote his last column for the Wall Street Journal just a week ago. It was a criticism of Chuck Schumer's demanding that Israel hold new elections. And it's just a sober reminder that, you know, even these people who have very long careers, and of course he'd been retired from the Senate for a decade, but even still very politically active and contributing a lot, can just, you know, just they're, when you're old, it can be sudden. Your decline can be sudden. So
falls at that age are no joke.
Yeah.
So MBD, you have foreign policy differences with with Senator Lieberman, and that 06 race, the Lamont primary, where Lamont took him out in the primary, and then Lieberman won as an independent. I was just, when I was reading the obit, we can forget just how intense that period was, and the contention over the Iraq war, which opposition to it totally took over the Democratic Party, and sort of had a delayed effect in terms of his influence on the Republican Party. But Trump is clearly a function of that. And you were, I imagine, a Lamont guy in that primary.
Yeah, I mean, I would have been just, you know, if it's a single issue, effectively a single issue decision there between a Democrat who was pro-war and anti-war at the time, I would have been for the anti-war one. I wasn't a voter in Connecticut. I was just starting out at the American Conservative at the time. I remember very well that 2006 year. I mean, that was the year of Jim Webb in Virginia, former Secretary of the Navy, running very critical of the Iraq War campaign. It was kind of the year that the Democrats became critical of the Iraq War, which the balance of them had supported initially. There were Republican critics too, just fewer and further between, guys like Walter Jones, Ron Paul, Sheldon Whitehouse on the other side. You know, what I think about when I think about Joe Lieberman, though, is I do think about him as this figure who,
you know, sits awkwardly, like his principles always sat awkwardly with the party. I mean, Maddie brings up how he condemned Clinton, and I think a lot of Democrats saw that as helpful to Bill Clinton at the time, which someone who would condemn him morally but not vote for his removal, you know, kind of giving a political expression to Democrats to give, you know, permission to allow him, a popular president, to continue in office while still expressing disgust at what he did. And, you know, it's funny, though, that years later, of course, it became fine to dump on what Clinton did because he could be portrayed as anti-feminist and he was no longer a political asset to the Democratic Party. But, like, when I think of Lieberman, too, it's just like his whole latter part of his career, it presents these junctures where the Democratic Party lurched left after him. You know, when he and Gore lost, Gore lurched to the left and never stopped lurching. Obviously, Ned Lamont was a lurch to the left for the Connecticut Democratic Party. And yeah, it hasn't stopped going that way since. So he was kind of orphaned by the tides of politics.
All right, so let me come out of left field with an exit question, just because we're here on the cusp of Good Friday and Easter. So I'm going to excuse Charlie from this exit question, unless he wants to answer. But MBD, let me start with you first, and I'll ask Maddie. So what do, you know, we talked about Lieberman's faith and how important it was to him. What do Good Friday and Easter mean to you?
Jeez. Well, salvation, of course, is what it boils down to. And what impresses me about Holy Week, in as we celebrate it in with the traditional liturgy of the Catholic Church, is just this very profound mystery where all of the kind of faithful throughout, the apostles and other disciples sort of are dramatized as turning against Christ in this final week, whether as a betrayer like Judas, a three times denier like Peter, or just running away, or anyone among the crowd that welcomed him into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday as a potential.
The falling asleep. Falling asleep in the Garden of Gethsemane and running away are just so, you can so imagine, like, that's what we'd all do, right?
Yeah. And then, you know, the people that get brought into it in a profound way are these strangers to the story, like Veronica or Simon of Cyrene. And I think it speaks to this profound difference of the Judeo-Christian tradition where we document painstakingly our failures to live up to our ideals. I mean, literally, I mean, the Good Friday liturgy tomorrow will include these beautiful polyphonic chants sung by the choir representing the whole congregation, chanting for, you know, crucify him and give us Barbarus, the murderer. So it's like we're literally assembled as a religious congregation, and we're asked to play the role of the religious mob that is betraying everything we're supposed to believe in. And I think it's just, I think that profound humiliation is to undergo that in the liturgy is the most healthy and transformative thing we can do. So I'm very grateful for it.
Maddie.
Yeah. So I think Good Friday is the ultimate reminder that sin and death are real, and specifically it's a time for me to meditate on my sin and my death. You know, Catholics start Ash Wednesday, so the beginning of Lent, with having ashes put on their forehead and reminder that you are dust and unto dust you shall return. But that is absolutely not the end of the story, and Easter is the time to remember that sin and death don't get the last word, that Christ rose from the dead, that he saved us from our sin if we only accept his offer. And so it's a very profound, I mean, if Christ really rose from the dead, it's the most profound consequential thing to ever happen in human history, and the most profound consequential thing for my life individually and for other Christians. So that's what I'm thinking about this weekend.
Yes, I think Good Friday, you can't get a starker statement of our pettiness, small-mindedness, sinfulness. We want Barabbas, right? End of the day, we want Barabbas. And then Easter is the starkest statement you can get, how love, ultimately, despite everything, is the most powerful force in the universe. With that MBD, let's hit a few other things before we go. You are slated to go see Godzilla versus Kong.
Yeah, my young son, I have somehow indoctrinated him into the Godzilla cult. I'm a big fan of the Toho movies. He's a big fan of the American monster movies, and playing Kaiju Universe, things like that. And so he wants the thrills and spills. And I think we're going to give it to him in the theaters this week at some point during spring break.
And Maddie, you saw Doubt on Broadway.
Yeah, this is a 2004 play by John Patrick Shanley about a Catholic school in the Bronx where the headmistress suspects the priest of sexually abusing one of the students. And it's delightfully ambiguous as to whether he did it or not, which hence the title Doubt. But it's just such a superb piece of writing, and it was starring Liev Schreiber, Amy Ryan, Zoe Kazan, so just a phenomenal cast. And actually afterwards there was a little panel where they had a sister from the order on which the play was based there, and it was just, you know, it was really quite touching to see secular actors sort of display warmth and open-mindedness to religious life and Catholicism generally, and sort of talk about some of the themes in the play, because it's by no means a sort of condemnation of Catholicism. It's a reckoning with real dark forces that were prevalent and doubtless still are. But but it was just really, really well done, and thoroughly enjoyed it.
So, Charlie, some people doubt the accuracy and usefulness of ChatGPT, but you have a counterexample.
So, a friend of mine subscribed to the paid version of ChatGPT, and apparently you can use this to upload images and have it describe them. And he uploaded an image of me on a lark, and the description is one of the funniest things I've ever read in my life, so I thought I would read a couple of paragraphs of it. The man's face is a tapestry of distinct features, bearing the markers of one who has lived and weathered various experiences. His complexion is fair, likely once smooth, now etched with the subtle lines of midlife that speak of years spent outdoors or in harsh weather, giving him a rugged aspect. A close study reveals the faint roadmap of laugh lines curving from the nostrils and spreading around the mouth, indicating a history of frequent smiles or perhaps a stoic demeanor frequently broken by mirth. His cheekbones are prominent, suggesting a strong bone structure beneath the facial hair, and there's a slight hollowness beneath them that accentuates their height and the contours of his face. His beard is a statement piece, full and bushy, covering much of his lower face. It has the unkempt look of a wild thing, free and untrimmed, and is interspersed with shades of brown and whispers of gray, particularly around the chin area, where the gray asserts itself more confidently. Etc., etc. I only regret that my Twitter bio can be maybe 40 words, and I can't put the whole thing in there.
Yeah, well, the next time I introduce you at an event, that's what I'm using, Charlie.
I'll make sure I keep this then.
So one of the more pleasurable things as a sports fan is when one of your teams is unexpectedly good, or at least performs better than predicted. And that's been true of my Washington Capitals. This is a team that is in decline. All the veterans are too old. They had a pretty good start, but you would expect them to slide off of that. And they did in the middle of the season, but have had a revival here towards the end. If the season ended right now, they'd be in a playoff spot. They had a really horrendously challenging schedule over the last 2 weeks. They've negotiated it successfully. Alex Ovechkin their signature star, had 8 goals as of 42 or 45 games into the season. And it just seemed like he was just falling off a cliff and would never reach Wayne Gretzky's goal scoring record. But he's had an amazing revival at 20 something goals now, is within 40 something of Gretzky. So even if they do make the playoffs, they're obviously going nowhere, but it's been fun because it's been better than the alternative. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is a Dan McLaughlin piece on the Department of Education's FAFSA fiasco. He outlines how the federal government has screwed up its own student loan process again, leaving tons of families in limbo. It's also revised it against families with multiple kids attending college at the same time, which I consider an attack on the lifestyles of the fecund Americans. So read Dan McLaughlin on FAFSA.
Maddie, what's your pick?
My pick is Kayla Bartsch's corner post, Abortion Robots Welcome to Hell, in which she documents her communications with the abortion bot Charlie, which is an AI chatbot launched last year, and just exposes how horrific that is, and sort of paints a bleak dystopian picture.
Charlie?
I'm going to pick our editorial on Joe Lieberman, titled simply Joseph Lieberman, R.I.P. It is pretty short. Just 3 paragraphs, but sometimes the best obits are, and this is one of them.
So my pick is, I mentioned her earlier in the week for her post about Jack Gaulke, a former Hillsdale student who excelled in the first couple games of the NCAA tournament. But I just want to mention Haley Strack again. She's one of our Buckley fellows. We usually have 2 Buckley fellows. We have 3 this year. They're all have been tremendous, but she's really taken up the cause of writing about the Gaza war and the horrors of Hamas. And just very often when a writer is emotionally invested in something, it produces the best kind of work. And that's true of what she's been doing. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or countless game without the express written permission of National U magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Made in Cookware, and thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. Happy Easter, everyone.